Hi, I'm Serena.
And I'm Rachel.
We're the hosts of Book Tales.
If you like reading books,
drinking cocktails,
and Scottish accents,
then meet your new favourite podcast.
Come with us as we explore different themes from romanticy to horror and everything in between.
We pair each book with a bespoke cocktail and tell you everything you'll need to make one.
And each week, play our fun game tailored to each book.
Find Book Tales wherever you get your podcasts. So grab your book.
Grab your booze.
For Book Tales.
Hi guys, I'm Brie.
And I'm Allie. This is Off Script.
If you think about it, books are potential scripts for movies.
When this adaptation happens, typically it's disappointing because they went off script.
In this series, we will be talking about how off script they went. Hello!
And welcome
to Off Script.
My voice is gone, you can barely hear.
Sorry, the off script.
A podcast. Yes.
Where normally we compare books to our movies.
But today is a very freaking exciting day.
So exciting.
I'm like so freaking nervous for this day.
Oh my gosh, it's going to be great. It's going to be fun.
I've literally been texting Allie all week like, oh my God, it's Saturday. Oh my God, what are we doing? Like, oh my God, what?
She's like, I can't sleep. I'm up till 2 a.m. I just am so nervous. I'm like, what is happening right now?
Why? Well, I think what happened was my brain kept pushing it. I was like, it's not for a while. It's way in December. And then this week, like Monday, I think, obviously I knew. I was like, okay, our interview's coming up. And then I think it was Wednesday or whenever I was texting you, like, I can't sleep. It hit me. I was like, oh my God, it's this weekend. It's Saturday. Am I prepared for this? I'm not prepared for this. What are we going to say? How am I going to act? What am I going to do?
I think my brain was so focused on, so I had Riley's birthday party sleepover yesterday, and my brain was so focused on, I hope these girls are quiet during the interview. So that's where my stress was, and Bree's stress was about the actual interview.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
But let's see how it goes.
Yeah.
Shall we?
Let's.
Wish us luck. But anyway, we didn't even say.
I'm Bree.
I'm Allie. And today we are interviewing
Edward Ashton.
The author.
Yeah, oh, go for it.
Nope,
you got this.
Nope, you go.
It's all you.
The amazing author of Mickey 7.
AKA Mickey 17. The movie.
And coming out with a book after the fall.
And really great book. You all should read it when it drops.
And he's done like February. In February. He's done like seven other books too, you guys.
Mm-hmm.
We have a legit author. I mean, not that our other authors have not been legit that we've talked to, but mind-boggling when authors agree to come on to our itty bitty podcast. I think it's so sweet.
I feel so freaking grateful. And I think this is like our previous authors. Yeah, I've been excited for them, but it's been mainly like your authors coming on. And so I think that made me excited. And once I realized, because for some reason I had it in my head that you didn't enjoy Mickey 7. And I was like, oh my God, I got another author that Allie's going to have to pretend to be like, oh, I enjoyed your book.
And you then didn't I remember that I loved it?
No. Then I listened to our episode and I was like, wait, Allie absolutely adored this book.
I loved it.
Then I got excited because this is a book that you and I both thoroughly enjoyed. Mm-hmm. So it was like,
yeah,
I think that's where my nerves came in.
Mm-hmm. So you guys, Edward Ashton wrote 3 Days in April, The End of Ordinary, Mickey 7, Antimatter Blues, Maul Goes to War, The Fourth Consort, and After the Fall. So, highly suggest.
Mm-hmm.
And are y'all ready?
Let's do it.
Let's go. We are here today with an amazing author. He has done works that we have covered, Mickey 7, turned into Mickey 17. And we are so excited to have Edward Ashton with us today. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really do appreciate it.
Of course.
Thank you for being here. We're so excited to talk to you. We really enjoyed Mickey 7. And then I read After the Fall and I absolutely loved it. I ate it up.
I'm so glad to hear that. That book After the Fall is really one of those, you know, authors talk about having a book of their heart. I mean, this is really one that's a book of my heart. So I'm really glad that you enjoyed it.
Oh, I'm excited to talk to you about it then. This is going to be fun.
I'm an audiobook person, being a single mom with littles running around. So as soon as the audiobook drops, because Brie got pre-release of the book. So as soon as the audiobook drops, I'm ready to go for it.
Well, I will tell you up front, the audio edition is absolutely fantastic. John Carolla did the recording, same person who did the recording for Mickey 7 and several of my other books. Cool. He just did an absolutely fantastic job. In particular, the voice that he gave to Martok. Brianna knows what I'm talking about.
I just
absolutely nailed it. Absolutely nailed it. I talked to him afterwards and he said it was one of the hardest recordings he'd ever done, because talking like Martok hurt his throat. And he had to take a break like every chapter to sort of drink some chamomile tea and rest in between. But you know, whatever he did, he absolutely nailed it. So I'm really excited to, you know, for you guys to listen to it and see what you think.
Yay.
Oh, I'm excited. I can't wait, because I have such a clear vision of how I hear all those characters talk. So I'm excited to see what he brought to life. That'll be fun.
I really loved him. So I listened to the book first for Mickey 7. And then when watched it and Robert Pattinson's voice, I was like, that's not correct. I know what he sounds like.
His own take on it, for sure.
Yes, he did.
He had an idea of what he wanted to do.
Yes, he did.
And he went with it.
He really did.
What's hilarious, so my boyfriend is not a fan of Rob, whereas I am. So I was really excited for this movie. Like, I had heard about this forever ago when it first got optioned. And I was like, yes, can't wait. Excited. And so I had been waiting for it. Then we saw a trailer for it in theaters. And my boyfriend turned to me and he was like, you know what? His voice sounds hilarious enough that I'll watch it with you.
I hope you liked the film. I hope it held up.
Yeah, he did. He really liked it a lot, actually. I was surprised, because not that it's an alien film, but you know, it's got the creepers in it. And so those creeped him out. Yeah, exactly. But he said, he was like, I actually enjoyed it though, like, surprisingly enough.
Well, I will tell you, Bong made the creepers a lot more cuddly in his movie than they were in my book. They were.
Oh, really? You know, okay.
If you look at how I described them in my book, they're much more horrific than the way.
That's what I thought. I was like, I feel like I'm not imagining the same thing.
Yeah.
But I guess this is a good segue. How do you feel that they did compared to your book?
That's a question I've gotten a lot.
Yeah.
My first answer is, like, so you're asking if me, like a mid-list author whose book was adapted by the most famous director in the world, you know, was I satisfied with the work that he did? I mean, what kind of a monster would I be if I said no?
Right.
You know, it's Bong Joon-ho. I mean, the man's a genius, and
yeah,
he did what he was going to do. But the more serious answer is that I've never thought that books and movies are things you ought to compare one to the other. They are different art forms.
Yeah.
What you can do on film, it's entirely different than what you can do on the page. And it's not a one-to-one translation. And so any movie that's adapted from a book, I see as a completely separate work of art that's in conversation with the original.
I actually got
a question from someone once. Did I feel that the movie had ruined my book? And I mean, the answer is, number one, you're out of your mind. Number two,
yeah,
my book's right there on the shelf. It's fine.
Right.
The movie did nothing to my book. I can go read it right now, and it's just the same as it was before. It's a different interpretation of the same story. And anytime it's like a band doing a cover of a song. You know, they bring their own things to it. They bring their own interpretations. You know, Jonathan Coulton's edition of Baby Got Back is very different from Sir Mix-a-Lot's interpretation of Baby Got Back, but they're both great works of art. You know, it's you have to appreciate them for what they are.
Right. Yeah, for sure. Plus, like, every single person, like, I'll read a book and Allie will read a book, and we always have a conversation about it, obviously. And I feel like the two of us have such different views in life and, like, where we are in our life that we read the book and get different aspects of the book thrown at us. And then we come together and we're like, oh, I didn't actually pick up on that bit that you caught.
Of course, every work of art is a conversation between the artist and the viewer, the listener, or the reader. That every reader, every viewer of a painting, they bring their own perspectives to things, and each one of us sees different things in any given work of art than anyone else. It's like I said, it really is a two-way street. It's not just the artist giving to the viewer. It's a back and forth. And you know, I probably shouldn't have done this, but occasionally I do poke my nose in and read sort of reviews on Amazon of my books. And man, some of the takes that people have are just, to me, are just crazy. Like, that's not what I said. That's not what,
right. Know,
good and bad. I mean, I've had people talk about some amazing insight that I had in one of my books. And like, I did not have that insight. I have no idea what you're talking about. I mean, that sounds great. I wish I did have that, but like, no, you brought that. You brought that to the table. Yeah. I'm glad you were able to take that out of the, you know, little story that I wrote, but that was from you. The same thing with some, you know, some bad things. I mean, I've had people, you know, imply that I was saying this or that, or, you know, things that are, you know, maybe not, not so great. And like, no, I didn't. I don't think that way. Yeah. I didn't write that way. You're bringing your own stuff to the table here.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I loved it. I remember I was reading it this summer while I was camping, and it's usually not my, like, I'm not super sci-fi like type of reader, but man, I remember sitting around, we went camping with my family, and I'm sitting there telling my brother, I'm like, okay, so then he like dies over and over again, and like I'm telling him all this stuff, and he's just like, okay. And I was like, it's really good, you gotta listen to it or read it. And then he's like, okay. And so I, big fan, I loved it.
Well, I will say that the kind of science fiction that I write is not the sort of science fiction that is only for science fiction fans.
True.
To me, I write stories that are about people. I don't write a story about the technology I read about in Popular Mechanics or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I just want to write about that technology, and my characters are all just sort of cardboard cutouts to support that technology. I don't really care that much about technology. I don't think most people do. I care about people and the relationships between people. I mean, if you ask me, what is Mickey 7 about? Mickey 7 is about a love story between Mickey and Nasha that spans multiple lifetimes. That's what it's about. All the other stuff is window dressing for that. You know, the heart of that story, when the movie was being developed and I spoke to Bong Joon-ho about what he was going to do with the script, one of the questions he asked me when, and this is just like a wonderful thing that Bong did for me, he did not have to do this. He asked me, what is the one part of your book that if it's not in the movie, it won't be your story? And whatever that is, I promise you, I'll put that in there. And he, like I said, he did not have to do that. I didn't have to think about it for more than 2 seconds. And I said, chapter 19. Chapter 19 has to be there. That's the chapter where all the medical experiments are going on, because that's the bond between Mickey and Nasha is forged. That's where they really are bonded and realize what they mean to each other. You know, it wasn't anything about the bioprinter or the spaceship or anything else. Yeah. It was that bit about the relationship. And Bong's answer was, I'm so glad you said that. I cried when I read that chapter. I was going to put it in anyway. And I said, can I pick something else? And he said, no. And that was my input to the script. That was all the input that I had.
Wow. Okay. I was going to ask that. Yeah. Okay.
But to me, that's the heart of the story. The heart of the story is the relationship between the people. And that not all science fiction is like that. Like Andy Weir, for instance, who my work has been compared to his a lot. And I love Andy Weir's work. I've read all of his books. I think they're great. But he writes a very different kind of science fiction. He writes
super scientific
puzzle books. Yeah, he writes puzzle books. It's one person alone solving scientific puzzles over and over and over. Mm-hmm. And he loves the details of like, how much poop does it take to be able to grow a potato? and have it not die. He really knows the answer to that question. He wants you to know that he knows. And that's great. Like, I found that really interesting. How much poop does it take? Turns out quite a bit. But that's not what I'm interested in. I'm not interested in poop or potatoes or anything else like that. I'm interested in relationships.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that you brought up the relationship between Mickey and Nasha, because I watched it before I read it and then I was sad. But honestly, I loved your book so much. So I feel like it enhanced the story for me rather than detracting from it. But when I watched it the first time through, I was really nervous that Nasha was going to end up like two-timing Mickey in some way, shape, or form. I was just waiting for that bit of the story. And then when it showed that she was with him through all of the experiments, I was like, oh no, she absolutely loves him. She is there with him 100%. She's not trying to two-time him in any shape or form. And then I went into the book and I was like, oh no, what if this is something they changed when they adapted it? And then I read it and I was like, oh, thank God. I'm so glad that it wasn't.
I will say it's so refreshing, because there are so many books now, they add that twist of the love, or, you know, best friend, or I mean, I guess the best friend was kind of slimy in this one, but like the love just turning on the main character. And I was so happy that that was not how this happened.
Yeah, I like I said, I really wanted that relationship to be the core of the book, and I didn't want to tarnish that. Now, I did, you know, I put the trials and temptations in there for them. He sort of cat tempts him at one point. A little more in the movie than in the book, honestly.
Oh yeah.
You know, they have, because if there's no option to be bad, it's no credit to you that you're good.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
I love that. So
you have to, there's an old saying that you can't be peaceful, for instance, if you're not actually capable of great violence. Because if you're not capable of violence, you're just harmless. And that's not the same as being peaceful. Being peaceful is choosing to be peaceful.
Aww.
And being true to Nasha has to be a choice. Like, he has to have had another choice, and he chose Nasha, and same for Nasha. She had other choices and she chose him. And that's what makes it meaningful. If they were just like two people stuck on an island and nobody else was around, then what does it really mean at that point?
Yeah. Right. Right. Exactly.
I love that.
So so you said how involved you were with the script, but were you involved at all on set, or nope, that was, they were doing their thing?
They flew me in to observe. So I got to come and watch some of the filming, which was great. I'm an engineer. I like how things work. I like to figure out, and I'd never seen a movie being made before. So this was really fascinating to me. I got to hang around with Duho Choi, who's Bong Joon-ho's production partner, has been working with him for many, many years. He kind of shepherded me around for the couple of days that I was there. I got to watch the way that director Bong works. He works in a way apparently that is very different from other directors. Bong shoots about 500 hours of film for every hour that makes it onto the screen, which is a much, much greater ratio than apparently any other working director. And I can testify to that. I don't know if you remember in the movie, there's one particular scene where the woman with the red hair, Mickey is going through his very first scan, and she pops a pimple on his forehead.
Yeah.
Right? I don't know if you remember that. It's kind of gross, right? It's about, the whole scene is about a minute long, minute and a half long.
Yeah.
That was 7 hours of filming.
Oh my gosh.
That scene over, and I watched them do it.
Wow.
And Bong's like, okay, now I need you to raise your right elbow by about 3 centimeters and drop your left hand by 2. Because, and then he films it over and he does it from another direction, because he wants every frame of his films to be composed like a painting, balanced in form and structure and color, so that it's not just the movie is a work of art, but every single frame is a work of art in and of itself, where you could just like capture that frame and put it on the wall. He's really, really particular about that in a way that, you know, many other directors, from what I was told, are not. So it was just fascinating. It was also really interesting to me because they did this movie with practical sets. That was not CGI. All that stuff there, that was all built out.
Really?
Like the snow was salt. They were dropping salt on them the entire time. They were doing the snowstorms. And the vehicles, those were actually built. The engineer who built them took me in. Like I said, I'm an engineer. I like how things work. The two of us like crawled into the inside of these machines, and he's pointing out to me how he took a farm tractor and turned it into these things by switching the gearings around and reversing the drive shaft and blah, blah. They practically had to pull me out by my feet from underneath this thing because we were just like peeking out in there and like, you can't spend
like, I just want to be right here
underneath the flitter. That's not okay. So,
oh my God,
it was an amazing experience. It really was. It was a once in a lifetime thing that I will absolutely never forget.
So now knowing this about Bong, are you glad that he's the one who signed on to adapt your film? Like, do you feel almost like, I don't know how to describe what I'm trying to say, but like, is it almost like a sense of pride or like a, like, thank you for taking my piece of art to make it your piece of art?
Absolutely. Not only because I feel like my book is one that could have gotten really misinterpreted and handled really badly in the hands of the wrong director, the wrong scriptwriter. I got asked a lot of questions during the production process about, well, are you nervous? Are you afraid of what they're doing to your baby? And my answer always was the same. This is Bong Joon-ho. No, yeah. I'm not nervous. Mm-hmm. Like this guy, he and I, and this is something I learned from being able to spend time with him over the course of the process. He and I actually see eye to eye on a lot of things in terms of sort of our worldview, our sense of humor, I think is pretty similar. That probably comes across in the movie. A lot of the jokes from the book he translated directly and really effectively into the film. He added some bits in the film that I wish I had written in the book. You know, that were really good bits, but bit tonally because like I think I have similar ideas on those sorts of things, and on some of the social commentary stuff. Also, he and I see really eye to eye, whereas somebody who had maybe different views might have misinterpreted what I was saying and put something out there that I would have been less happy with. So no, I was absolutely thrilled start to finish. It was really an honor to be able to work with someone of that stature and magnitude. And I will never say it. And also, and I said this before, but I will repeat this as many times as I can, Bong is one of the kindest and most genuine people I have ever met. Like while I was there on set, they said he's incredibly busy, right? They're at a really tight production schedule. They had 90 days to get this whole thing filmed.
Wow.
He took an hour out of his day to personally tour me around the set and show me all the stuff that he had built. And at one point, he reached over, he grabbed a little piece of scenery and tucked it into the back pocket of my pants and leaned into my ear and said, "Don't worry, they won't notice. Just take it home."
Oh my gosh.
I'm going to show you this. I don't know if you can see that.
Yeah.
Ashton PD. I don't know if you know
the
name of the town where Alan Manicova did his serial killing was Ashton. Like, yeah. That was like a little Easter egg for me. And he made this badge for me. This is like a heavy duty police badge. And he gave it to me at the premiere. And now it's like sitting in a place of honor on my desk. Again, there was no reason to do that. None at all. Except just to be. And like I said, I will always remember that.
That's amazing. He seems, in interviews that I've seen with him, he seems like one of the nicest men out there. And I'm like, most directors aren't like that.
Yeah. I don't know a lot of directors, but I can tell you, he genuinely is. He is a kind, warm, thoughtful person. There's no other way to describe it.
That's amazing.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. How did you feel about... I know we ask these questions and some people are like, I can't really answer that. How do you feel about the casting? Do you like all how your characters were portrayed in the film?
I thought the characters who were my characters, which not all of them were, right? Bong added some characters and mixing things around. I thought the cast of Naomi Aki as Nasha was brilliant. Yeah. I thought she absolutely nailed it. I thought she was really spectacular. I thought Robert did a great job with Mickey as well. Now, obviously, there were some differences in the way that Mickey sort of written in the script as opposed to the book. You know, I wrote Mickey as someone who was, he's competent, he's courageous, he's sort of a man out of his time. Where he doesn't really fit in with the era that he's born into, but it's not that he's a doofus. He's not dumb or immature or anything like that. Bong took it a little bit of a different direction. And there were reasons he did that from a plot development standpoint. There were some things, there were some stories he wanted to tell that were a little different than the story I told. And so he, you know, he had, you know, Mickey 17 in particular, sort of a pathetic character. I think Bong actually described him as being a pathetic character, which is not how I wrote Mickey in my book. You know, Robert had to play him in a very different way because of the way he was written in the script than he would have if you were playing him straight as he would fit in the book. But I thought he did a fantastic job with it. It's, you know, being able to portray those two characters at the same time and make it clear, like one sentence out of their mouth, you know exactly which one is speaking.
Yeah, that's impressive.
You know, it was impressive. It was an impressive piece of work.
Allie always finds fun facts to put into our episodes, and she found one that said that they also didn't tell Rob like who he was playing to get the confusion in. And that blows my mind too, because I'm like, how do you do that then? Like, how do you go into a scene like, okay, I'm ready, I'm gonna talk like this?
He absolutely nailed it. Like I said, there's a one scene where Notch actually draws a 17 and an 18 on their chest.
Yeah.
I didn't even think that was necessary. Like I said, it just from their body language, from their facial expressions, you could tell instantly which one he was portraying at any given time. It was impressive acting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That relationship too, it kind of threw me off when I read it, because the relationship between 17, well, not 17 and 18 in the book, but between those two was so different in the book, because in the movie, obviously, there needed to be a little bit more drama and a little bit more like, ooh, they're angry at each other and they both want to be there, but they can't be. Whereas in the book, they were like working together, like, yeah, let's try and actually both survive this.
Yeah, well, like I said, he had some different stories he wanted to tell. Director Bong saw this as partially a coming of age story where he sees Mickey 17 as a child and Mickey 18 as a man. And that's also why he chose 17 and 18, because 17 and 18 is sort of the boundary between being a child and becoming a man, right?
That's cool.
And that's, and I don't know if you remember, there's a scene at the end where it's a dream sequence where Mickey finds Ilfa, you know, at the bioprinter producing a new copy of Marshall. And a lot of people seem to find that a little confusing, but the reason that was there, you know, at the end of that scene, he says, I thought about what 18 would do. And I wasn't afraid for the first time. I wasn't afraid. And that's the moment. That's the moment where he grows up. He's a man.
Oh,
being a child to being a man.
Wow. I took it completely differently.
But again, that's not a story that was, that's not an aspect that was in my book. That's not something I wanted to explore. That's something that Bong brought to the story himself, which is great. He's, you know, he was going to interpret the story the way that he wanted to interpret it. But that's why the characters had to be so different in the movie, as opposed to the way they were in the book, where what I was talking about in the book was more along the way that people change over time. So, you know, if you think about yourself, like I think probably a little bit older than you all. But when I think back about myself when I was 20 years old, 25 years old, I was a completely different person. Like my wife has told me, if I had met you when you were 20, we would never have dated, let alone got married. You know, I was a very, very different person. And if you're that different over 25 or 30 years, it stands to reason that you're actually a little less different over 5 years, or over 2 years, or 1 year, or 6 months, or 6 weeks. You know, we're continuously changing. We're becoming different people all the time. And Mickey 7 and Mickey 8 are only separated by 6 weeks. But those are like some traumatic things happening in that 6 weeks. And I wanted to show, even in that short period of time, they're slightly different people. They're not radically different. They're mostly the same still, but they have a little different outlook on life. And that was something I wanted to illustrate in my book. That was not an avenue Bong wanted to pursue in the movie. He had other stories he wanted to tell.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that you just told us that, because I really just thought he wanted the comedic story of showing Mickey die at least 17 different ways.
I'm sure that was part of it too. You know, I'm sure he thought I was insufficiently murderous. That's okay. And it was a fun sequence, right? Where they're shoving down the corpse hole over and over again. I mean, that was fun to watch. But yeah, there was something deeper behind it than that.
That's awesome.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, is there anything else about Mickey 7, or should we move on?
Jump into After the Fall.
Yeah.
Hey, it's your show.
Okay. Go for it, Brie.
All right. So to start us off with After the Fall, is there anything that you just want to talk about for a little bit before I ask some questions about the book itself?
Sure. I mean, I you know, for those of your listeners who have not read the book, which is presumably all of them, so After the Fall is my newest book. It's my 7th novel. It is published. It'll be released in February. It is set in a future where there's been a catastrophe, a sort of environmental catastrophe on Earth. 99%+ of all humanity has been wiped out. The survivors have been subjugated by aliens who have come and sort of picked through the wreckage and formed their own little colony here. And as you can imagine from that setup, it's basically a lighthearted buddy comedy that centers around an effort to get a new bed and breakfast off the ground. So it's like all my books, it is a dark comedy, but I think it's got some serious things to say as well about power differentials and relationships. And if you can really form a friendship across sort of vast differences in power and social structure. And so it was a really fun book to write. And like I said, it is a book that I have a deep emotional attachment to for reasons that we can go into if you want to go into that. Let's see what you guys took from it, what questions you might have.
Yeah. Well, first, I love your writing because I really thought our talk was going to, again, be a jerk at the end of the book. And then I was like, oh no, you're just a sweet, bumbling guy who I just want to go and give a hug because you're trying to help, just not in a great way.
He's doing his best, you know, he's doing his best, which is all any of us can do.
Yeah. Okay. So I have such a hard time when I'm reading. I've learned I think in words. So when I'm reading, it's really just words that I see rather than pictures. So I was trying to envision what the grays are. And like, I kept just assuming they were big owls, but then the walrus tusks would get described. And I was like, hold on. What do you see when you're writing about the grays?
So the way that I imagine them, the way they look to me is more like, so I always try to think, you always have to think in terms of like the biology that we know on Earth, right?
Yeah.
And make some analogy to that. I thought of them as sort of like elephant people, like kind of two-legged elephant people, because they've got the thick three-fingered hands, they've got the little upturned tusks.
Wow.
I talk about their ears flopping around to say yes or no instead of nodding their heads. And this is just sort of part of my style, I guess. I don't spend pages and pages of detailed description on exactly how things look. I kind of let my readers use their imagination. Some people love that. Some people it makes them mad. But that's just kind of how I think. And so that winds up being how I write.
I like that because kind of like what we talked about already, it's a relationship with your reader. You're letting them create what they can from your book.
Exactly.
And giving them the story of it rather than just being like, okay, so point blank, here's what it is.
So in a while you realize that you've made a real connection. So like there's a special edition of Mickey 7 that they did from Fantasia Press. They did a limited edition where it's all signed and numbered and whatever. And they commissioned an artist to draw the cover for that and paint the cover for it, which most people don't do right now. You know, like Macmillan, when they do your covers, they've got a graphic designer, not an artist. They're like drawing a scene from they're kind of taking images from the web and putting them together and whatever. But this guy actually drew a scene from the book on the cover of the book, and he had the creepers in there, and he drew them like point on exactly how I imagined.
Wow. Whoa.
Precisely. Absolutely nailed it. Which tells me, like, apparently I described them adequately because he absolutely nailed it. And they are horrific. You know, the way he drew them. They're
awesome.
Bongs are just like cuddly bunnies compared to the way that this guy drew them. And he was right. You know, like I said, the artist there really nailed it.
Which I also almost think is I almost wish that the creepers looked creepier in the movie, because then it wouldn't be so obvious that they were trying to help. Because, like,
well, I'll tell you why he did that. Yeah. That was a deliberate choice. I mean, everything that director Bong does is a deliberate choice. There is nothing random that happens in any of his films. Everything in there is there for a reason. So he did realize that he needed the audience to be sympathetic to the creepers by the beginning of the third act. The audience had to be sympathetic or else the third act means nothing. Mm-hmm. And so in my book, I wanted it to be really hard for the reader to sympathize with the creepers, because part of what I was writing about was this question of like, who gets the privilege of being thought of as a person? Who gets a privilege of being something or someone that we don't want to kill because it's got its own agency, it's got its own personhood? Bong was taking a slightly different tack to that. And he was showing the creepers as potential victims. And to do that, you have to have the audience sympathize with them. And visually, the audience would have had a really hard time sympathizing with them the way that I drew them, the way that I wrote them up. So he had to soften them up. And he gave them those sort of elephant eyes, those big expressive elephant eyes. Yeah. And they're kind of furry and kind of the babies in particular.
Like, yeah.
They had plushies of the babies at the premiere. And like, I wanted one so bad. They were so cute. They had any one.
I would have loved that.
Yeah. So like I said, there was a reason that he did
makes sense. That actually makes so much sense. I feel like Allie said this to me at the end of it, because Ender's Game is one of my favorite books. And my favorite part about it is at the end when he realizes, like, oh shoot, this whole time I've been killing the aliens for real. This wasn't a game. Yep. And she was like, it kind of felt like that at the end, where it was like, oh shoot, these guys aren't really like something we should be killing. Like, why are we trying to go after them? So I loved that.
Yep. So, similar themes, you know, as writers, we're all standing on each other's shoulders. And, you know, I'm sure Ender's Game was probably in the back of my head somewhere when I was writing those scenes.
Yeah. Okay. Back to After the Fall. So what's funny is when I showed Allie the cover of it, she looked at it and went, oh, is that the gray? And I was like, no. And then she's like, well, how does this tie into it? And I was like, I don't know. I don't know if this actually does tie in, or what are your thoughts with it? Like, did someone come up with it for you?
No, as an author, you have no input into the cover, right?
Oh, I didn't know that.
The marketing department at the publisher puts out the cover and they send it to you and say, this is the cover of your book. That's it. We do not get input. In a couple of cases, I've had them ask, like, do you have some ideas for what we ought to do? And I'll give them my thoughts, and then they either do it or they don't. I actually had some ideas for the cover for After the Fall, which they did not use at all. Wow. Kind of completely ignored it. Which is like, that's, they're right. It's, the cover is considered a marketing thing, not an artistic thing or part of the author's work. And they have a marketing department, and they do what they think they can do to best market the book. In terms of how it connects, there is, you may remember in the book, there's a little bit of discussion about humans and how they relate to the grays, and they talk about wolves, right?
Yeah.
And the feral humans they talk about are like wolves, and John and Six are just like dogs, right? And so what they're trying to do with that cover is like, this planet used to be owned by wolves, right? The feral humans used to own this whole planet, and now they're gone, and all that's left is just sort of the memory of them.
Okay.
So that's what that kind of bust of a wolf in a suit was on the front.
That makes sense. I was thoroughly confused when I got to the end, because when I had showed her it, I was like halfway through it, and I was like, so far, I don't like totally see it, but maybe. And then I got to the end and I was like, I feel like I'm surprised. I didn't realize that authors just didn't get to be like, hey, this doesn't tie into my story at all. Can we do this?
I will say, one of my friends saw the cover and and had not seen the book. And the first thing she said was, did you write a book about furries? Because if so, I don't know if I want to read it. And I had to explain to her that no, that is not what this is about at all. No.
Oh my gosh.
But that's my second book. The cover is a piece of corn, There's a big piece of corn on the cover.
Oh, okay.
And I got absolutely roasted about that one. I mean, I got much grief from different people about the corn cover. but like I said, as an author, that's totally out of your hands.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess at that point, you're just kind of excited that your book's becoming a book. So you're like, put a piece of corn on it.
You know, I'm sure like if you're John Scalzi or somebody, you can call their marketing department up and say, no, you're going to change that. But like, I'm not at that place in my career. I can't. Yeah. I don't have that kind of juice at this point. I can't do it.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
So I read After the Fall pretty quickly after I had finished Mickey 7. Mm-hmm. And I feel like with authors, obviously, all authors have a style of writing and they all have their own clear voice. But like when I read Stephen King back to back, I feel like I'm not even changing books because it's all the same writing. So I kind of went into After the Fall assuming I was going to be reading just a different version of Mickey 7. And after the like second chapter, I realized that it didn't even feel like you're writing. Like, obviously it did, but it wasn't like I was jumping back into Mickey 7. So I just wanted to know, how do you give each book its own voice? And how do you make sure that, yes, it's your writing, but you're keeping the stories so far apart from each other that it doesn't feel like I'm reading the same author?
That's an important line you have to walk as an author. You don't want to be unrecognizable in your voice. Yeah. You want a reader to be able to pick up your book and say, oh yeah, this is so-and-so's book. You know, when you have, and some writers do have much more diverse voices and they want to they want to write in one genre in a different genre. And typically when they do that, they use pen names. So like T. Kingfisher writes as T. Kingfisher when she writes one sort of book and has a pen name when she's working on other kinds of books. That's a pretty common thing. So your readers don't get confused, because like if your first book is a rom-com and your second book is a dark personal memoir of trauma and drug addiction, you're going to throw your readers off. You're not going to make anybody happy there. And maybe you do want to write both those books, but you're going to want to use a pseudonym for one of them so that your readers don't get confused. So I do try to have a voice. I think I do have a distinct voice.
Yeah.
You do. But at the same time, you can't just churn out the same thing over and over and over again, because then people get bored. And so I do work really hard in terms of, you know, once I've drafted my first draft of the book, I'm still, you know, 5 or 6 months from being able to turn this into my agent, because I go through it. I'll go through the entire manuscript probably between 25 and 50 times, rewriting different parts of it to get the tone right, to get the voice right, to make sure that, again, that it sounds like me, but at the same time, it doesn't sound like none of my characters sound like just like the characters from the other books. I can't have Mickey Barnes's voice coming out of Martok's mouth. It's really important for me to get, and that's something that you really have to work at. It really is something you have to work at. So I'm glad that you thought that I succeeded there, because that is that's one of the hardest parts of the whole business.
Oh yeah, no, I literally like so early on, I was like, oh, this is not like Mickey 7. Like it is, but it's so different that it's not. And honestly, like 3/4 of the way through the book, I realized I was like, I'm a fan of him. Like, I will read any book he writes. I've loved Mickey 7. This one's amazing too. Like, can we get more?
Well, like I said, I've got, I am under contract for 3 different new books right now. So I'm writing 2 books at the same time right now, which I've never tried before. That's a real challenge.
How do you do that?
Well, I'm contracted with 2 different publishers.
Oh my god!
Once with my U.S. publisher, so yeah, it's a challenge. It's a little bit of a balancing act.
I was gonna say, how do you switch?
I was just gonna ask, like, now that we're talking about your voice, how do you then go and write 2 books at the same time and make sure that you're like, okay, this is your story and this is your story?
So one of the things that's and this is, you know, also that relates to the question of like, how do I do this while also I don't know if I mentioned this. I'm a cancer researcher. That's my
what?
Day job.
No,
awesome.
So I run clinical trials.
That's amazing.
So that's,
How do you do that and write books?
Well, see, that's the answer to the question is that, you know, I feel like everybody, we've all got like little superpowers. We've got little things that we do different or better than other people. One of the things that I'm able to do is I'm really good at switching focus from one thing to another. So, you know, I can be taking a call with like the lead scientist from some big pharma company talking about like KT inhibitors and blah, 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 blah. Hang up from that. I got 15 minutes to my next call. I pop open my laptop. I was in the middle of a sentence. I remember exactly where I was in that sentence. I remember exactly what I was saying and what was going on in the previous paragraph. I can bang out 200 words in that 15 minutes, close it back up, and then be ready for my next call. And I can do the same thing, switching back and forth between different plots. I can keep that stuff straight in my head. I have a lot of author friends. That is not how most people operate. Most people have, we all have our own processes. And I'm not in any way saying my process is better or worse than anybody else's. It's just, I think it's pretty unique to me. I've never met anybody else who works quite the way I do. In some ways, I would love to work the way some of my friends do. It sounds like it's a lot easier in some ways, but I'm juggling a lot of stuff in my life, and this is the only way this is going to work for me. So
that's so impressive. I forget what I'm thinking half the time. So the fact that you can just jump right back into what you were writing and remember everything, that blows me away.
Well, here's the thing. Like I said, I feel like everybody has their things. And when you see somebody who's really good at something, it's a pretty good bet that they've got a big deficit someplace else, because we've all got the same 3 pounds of goo inside of our heads. It's just you can allocate it to different stuff. So, yeah, I can do that. But then just as an example, at my work, there was a woman that I'd worked with for probably 6 or 7 years. She had been my assistant coach on my daughter's basketball team. She tinted her hair, and I introduced myself to her and welcomed her to the team when I saw her in the office. I had no idea who she was. None. This was somebody I'd known for 7 years. And literally, like, she didn't do a total makeover. She literally put in highlights. I was like, hi, welcome. My name's Ed. I'm blah, blah, blah,
What's
blah,
your
blah.
Name?
And she's like, you idiot.
Oh my God.
Idiot. I've known you forever.
Oh, no.
So like there are definite like chunks of my brain that should be doing things like recognizing your coworkers that have just been like reallocated to do other stuff.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. So I have a question. We talked about how with Mickey 7, your like what you were writing was how people can change. So with After the Fall, what was the story that you were writing? Because to me, it was literally like I took away, honestly, John and Martok's relationship. Like, John was very much like, I am just his pet. I am not someone he cares for. And that changed over time. It took a long time for it to change, but it changed over time. And that was my favorite part of the story, because I loved Martok from the start. And I was like, John, just realize he's good.
So that is, you know, that is the story that I wanted to. So I told you this is a book that has a really deep emotional resonance with me. So I had a dog named Max. I had him for 16 years. He was my best friend. You know, every time I went to sit down, he was like flopped on me. He followed me everywhere I went. When I lost my mom a few years ago, Max and I disappeared into the woods for 12 hours and we just walked. And I lost him 2 years ago. You know, he was 16 years old and he had just like, he'd used up all his dog juice. He didn't have any left. And that was that. And when that happened, I started thinking, I knew what the relationship that I had with him was to me, but I didn't know what it was to him. Oh. And I wanted to think about, I wanted to explore like, what was that relationship like for him? And that's what I was writing from John's perspective. Not that John's actually Martok's dog or anything, but like he does, they do think of each other that way in some ways. They do have that power imbalance, just like there was a power imbalance between me and Max. You know, if I wanted to go for a walk this way, Max didn't get to like have a voice and say, no, I want to go that way. You know, we're going the way I want to go because like I'm the human and he's the dog. And in a lot of ways, that's not fair. right? Yeah. Maybe Max had really good reasons he wanted to go that way. He knows some really smelly deer carcass over there that he really wanted to check out. You know, but I got to overrule him, and that's not super fair. And that sort of power differential, can you have a real friendship when there's a complete differential in power like that? That's the question I wanted to explore.
Oh my gosh.
I love that.
That just made me love the relationship. Oh my gosh, I'm such a dog person now. I'm just like, okay, can't wait. I'm gonna audiobook this like crazy. I'm so excited. Okay.
All right. So if you were to adapt this book into a movie, who would you want to direct it? And who would you cast for the lead parts of it?
That's really tough. I don't really
also,
know.
Also, would you
many
want
directors.
This adapted?
Oh, I think it would make a great film, honestly.
Yeah,
I really think it would make a great film. I don't even think it would be that difficult to film because there's only a couple of sets.
You
know, you got the house in the woods, you got the woods, you got, you know, some of the characters are kind of monstery. So that might be a little tricky, but like they make Gollum, they can make Bartok.
I would
put some white ping pong balls on somebody and throw some. That shouldn't be too tough. But yeah, a few years ago, I would have said maybe Andre the Giant would be pretty good for Martok. He's unfortunately shuffled off his mortal coil, so that's not going to work anymore. I don't know. Maybe trying to think who would be the biggest oafish actor that I can think of right now. It's, you know, I'm more of a book person than a movie person. So, you know, I don't have a lot of names that I could throw out. And like I said, directors, I don't know.
I
know Bong just because I know Bong. You know, if he wants to direct any more movies about my books, like God bless. But I think he's probably done all the Ed Ashton books that he's going to do in his career. So
he's like, this is the only one I wanted. We're good.
Yeah. No. Yeah, there you go.
Yep. That's just like me. I'll do this was directed by this person. Bree's like, wow, and I'm like, I don't know who that is, but okay, great.
Yep.
So famous.
I have a degree in film, and so if I wasn't that into that world, I would think that, you know, I would have been trying to follow the wrong career path there. But
I know a lot more about film now than I did 5 years ago, but that's still not very much.
Well, I just think it's amazing that they actually flew you out, because we've asked a few authors now who've had their books adapted, and most of the time it's like, no, like we got asked if we wanted to get it made into a movie and that was it. And that blows my mind, because it's like, how do you take someone else's work and just be like, okay, it's mine now, bye. turn it into what you want.
When you sign that option deal, you've signed away every bit of your rights. They can do anything they want with that book. They can destroy it if they want to. And there's literally nothing that you can do. But Warner Brothers, I will say, was like super nice to me. It wasn't just that they flew me out. Like, they flew me first class. They had somebody waiting for me, and my wife. They brought my wife along too, paid for all of her stuff as well. When we landed in London, there was somebody waiting for us at the gate. Like, I didn't know you could even do that. Waiting at the gate to escort us through the secret security line, where we didn't have to go through immigration and customs like all the normal people. They took us through the special celebrity whatever customs place where there's nobody there, and we just walked straight through. They had a handler there who was assigned to just take care of us the whole time we were there, take us wherever we want. They put us up on this $4,000 a night estate outside of London. It was My wife was like, I don't think I can ever travel again after this. Like, I've been ruined. I can't go back to coach now. I can't.
She's calling Warner Brothers. Hey, can you book me a trip right over here?
No, it was amazing. And then they flew us out again for the premiere, of course, and again treated us gold. I mean, it was just really the entire experience was so positive. There was just amazing. No, I cannot think of a single negative thing about the entire process.
Oh, that makes me so happy. Awesome. That makes me happy for you, because I know.
Well, thank you.
I've talked to quite a few authors now who have had quite the opposite experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know it's not typical. I know the experience I had was not typical, but it was, mm-hmm. like I said, there's just absolutely not a single negative thing I can say about anyone involved in the entire process.
That's amazing. We had two listener questions about After the Fall, but you pretty much already talked about them. It was, what was your inspiration for After the Fall, and what is the main theme of the book? So we know now it's your dog.
Kind of hit on that, yeah.
Yeah, just a little bit.
I love it.
Is there anything else that you want us to know about After the Fall?
The big thing is that it's a thinky book a little bit, like all of my books are, but it's fun. And yeah. my first thing, whenever anyone says, like, what was your goal with this book? My goal with every book is to be entertaining. I feel like literature, if it's not entertaining, I'm not out here to teach you lessons. I'm not out here to, like, impart a philosophy to you or something like that. I'm not out here to give you science facts. You know, there are some science facts that pop up in my books, but only in service of being entertaining, typically. Yeah. So it's like, it's a fun book. You'll get some fun little philosophical stuff stuck in there, but like mostly you'll have a good time if you read it. And that's, to me, that's the most important thing.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I ate it up. I finished it in a week and I just was like, I'm in love with this book. I love these characters. I can't wait to see what's going to happen next. This is insane. So I enjoyed it so much.
I appreciate that. I really do.
Yeah, of course. We are now to our wrap-up questions, which are kind of fun. They're in line with our podcast of comparing books to film. Do you have a favorite book to film adaptation apart from Mickey 717?
So I can give you two, depending on your definition of favorite. In terms of my, you know, one of my all-time favorite movies, which is a book-to-film adaptation, of course, is The Princess Bride. There are, you probably noticed in Mickey 7, there's a couple of Easter eggs in there that are just like, you know, shout-outs to The Princess Bride. That's a movie that I've seen like 100 times. And
that could makes me so
almost
happy.
All of it, top to bottom. And the book is brilliant, too. Like, the book is absolutely fantastic. But then in terms of, like, I think you also have to talk about where the movie really added something and did better than the book.
Yeah.
And so this is not as much a favorite movie of mine, but in terms of the quality that the movie added beyond what the book gave, was a movie called Stardust, which is based on a book by Neil Gaiman. And the book, I actually read the book. The book's kind of meh, honestly. Yeah. The book is... but the movie is fantastic. I mean, they changed a bunch of stuff, and everything that they changed made it better, in my view. Mm-hmm. Like, in particular, the ending of the book is just like a shrug. Why did we do that? The ending of the movie is like heart pounding. It's spectacular. So, that's to me that's where the movie makers really took the book and said, we can do something more with this. We can make this really great, and I think that they did.
Yeah, we covered that one, and we had the same thoughts, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I love that movie. I didn't even realize it was a book until we started this podcast. And so when I realized that, I was like, oh, we got to do Stardust. Because I just,
like I said, the book's not great. The book's okay. Yeah. It's okay at best.
Yeah. Here's the problem with watching the movie first, because then I went into the book assuming I was going to get the same story. So I like went into it like, yes, I love the movie so much. Let's read it. And like after the second chapter, I was like, oh no, why is this so different?
It's not the same.
No.
Yes. Also, I'm so glad you said that about The Princess Bride, because there were parts in Mickey 7 when I was reading it where I was like, that feels like a Princess Bride nod, but I'm not sure. So I'm not even going to, I'm just going to keep going.
For sure. I dropped a couple of those in there. I've got those scattered around through a lot of my work. It's like I said, that's a movie and a book that keeps up a big chunk of my brain space.
I love it so much. Mm-hmm. Do you have a least favorite book to film adaptation?
I do actually. So one of my favorite authors, one of my personal heroes, somebody that I grew up reading and have always kind of idolized, is David Brin. I know if you're familiar with David Brin at all. He wrote a ton of books. His most famous books are, he has these Uplift trilogy, which is just absolutely great. If you're looking for some science fiction, you read at some point. But he wrote a book called The Postman. And The Postman is a great book. It's a really thoughtful, intelligent book that has some things to say about society and et cetera, et cetera. And Kevin Costner took it and adapted it into a movie a few years back. And I saw a list a while ago of the top 100 worst post-apocalypse films of all time. And The Postman was number 3.
Oh, no.
Waterworld was number 1, interestingly. But Costner was like 2 of the top 3 on that list. So that's something to be excited about. But that was a case where I feel like the movie really just did not do justice to a really brilliant book. And I think part of my disappointment in the movie, obviously, is driven by how much I love the book.
If I
had not liked the book so much, I probably would not have thought so badly of the film. But
for sure.
Yeah, in terms of my bottom of the heap, that would definitely be it.
That makes sense.
Good to know. Yes. Okay. We'll keep that in mind. Is there a book out there that you would love to see adapted?
Yeah, I really think going back to David Brin, the Uplift trilogy, I think would be absolutely fantastic. It was really popular when I was a kid. It's an older book, and they couldn't have done it at that time. I understand why you couldn't adapt something like that at that time. It's got a lot of creatures in it, like a lot of characters are creatures.
Oh, that makes sense.
But like I said, you got CGI now. They can do anything with that kind of stuff. I think you could totally do it now, and it's this really sort of heart pounding story. It's got this great universe world building background, and it's got like. Characters where it's right, some sentient dolphins hanging around and some chimps that can talk and really, really fun cast of characters and a really interesting kind of backstory to the whole thing. And I think it would make it just an absolutely fantastic film. I don't know if it'll ever happen, but I really hope that it does.
That'd be cool.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. Is there a movie that you wish had a book? Like you wish they could have given you more detail on certain aspects of the movie?
This is our hardest question.
Yeah,
that's a tough one, but yeah, I mean, I think there's a movie called The Fifth Element.
Yes. Oh yeah. Yeah.
Bruce Willis. Yeah, yes. That's one that they're like. I feel like there's a lot more than what you saw on the screen, right? It seemed like there's a whole backstory there that they couldn't get out on the screen. That's mm-hmm. what I think would make a really fun book. I think you'd do a lot with that.
That's our best answer we've gotten.
Yes. Because we understand. I'm just like okay after the movie, and I'm like, that's probably why it's missing too much. Yes.
Yeah.
And do you have a? Oh,
yep. Go for it, okay. Allie.
Do you have a favorite book? Well, you kind of did. You say it, or is there a different one that you're?
Oh no. In terms of favorite books, just as books, that's a tough one for me because I read a lot. And there's a lot of books that I love, but if I had to pick one, there's a book called Cat's Cradle by Kurt Vonnegut. Ooh, I don't know. Are you familiar with it?
It sounds familiar. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's a book that's like a lot of Vonnegut books. It's very sardonic. It's very dark. It's sort of a parody on the military industrial complex. The idea is that they've invented a new form of water called Ice 9, which freezes at a much, much higher temperature, freezes at like 105 degrees. And they're really excited about this from a military standpoint, because when you sort of like the way prions work, when you drop it into water, it teaches all the water around it how to be ice 9. And so like if you have to move your tanks across a swamp, you can just put a drop of ice 9 in the swamp, and it'll all freeze over, and you can just drive your tanks right over it. And what they don't think is that all the water on the planet's connected. And so some of this stuff gets out, and basically all the water on the planet freezes over, including all the water inside of human beings who touch it. And so the whole book is like the last surviving anything left on Earth this one island in the Caribbean. Like everything else is dead, and they're going to be dead really soon, and they know it, and there's nothing they can do about it.
Oh my god!
And there's this.
It sounds really good.
It's beautiful, and there's a little love story in it. And at the end, there's this scene, and I used to have it memorized word for word the entire thing. But basically, the protagonist and this girl that he's been in love with are on this mountaintop with a bunch of people who are frozen, who got some of this Ice Nine in them, and they're statues. They're turned into human statues. And she says, do you love me? And he hesitates. And she says, too late. And he says, and she touched her finger to the ground. She laughed and touched her lips and died.
Oh.
Just like that. No dramatics to it, no histrionics. But yeah. It is such a punch in the gut. It is such a punch in the gut. I mean, I read that the first time when I was probably 14 or 15 years old, and I can still remember how it felt to read that line.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the things that I thought when I read that was, I want to be able to write a line like that someday.
Oh, yeah.
And I will never be Kurt Vonnegut's. But we all have things that we aspire. You know, I wanted to be able to shoot a three-pointer like Larry Bird at 1.2, and I never got to do that either, but like I try. And that's kind of where I am with the writing. I'll never be Kurt Vonnegut, but I can try, you know, and as long as I keep trying, I feel like I'm making progress.
For sure.
That's wonderful. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Do you have a favorite movie?
I'm just going to be generic here and say that, you know, that, like I said, The Princess Bride, I've watched it a million times. You probably get that from like half the people that come on your podcast, but it's a fantastic,
it's a classic. Course,
with the loss of Rob Reiner this week, it made me think about it even more. And it's just, and the story behind the film, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, it's, I know if you've already read interviews about, I went to see a screening of it with Cary Elwes once, where he did a talk at the beginning. He talked about kind of the disaster that the filming of that was. And like Cary Elwes, he broke his foot early on in the filming. And there are a bunch of scenes where if you know like this, the duel scene on the top of the mountain, he had a broken foot.
Oh my gosh, you
kind of see it. If you watch it, you can see how they're cutting away, and you can see him wincing in pain in places because steps on his broken foot. And to have all these disasters occur and still have come out with this like just brilliant piece of art, as far as I'm concerned, it's just really an amazing story.
That's awesome. I love that movie.
Mm-hmm. It's a great movie. It's one of my favorites.
It really is.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Well, that's all of our questions. So now you have an opportunity to share any last minute things you want, share where people can find you, share previous work, future work, whatever you want to share about.
Sure. So like I said, I've got 7 novels out right now. You know, you can find all my work at edwardashton.com. There's links there. In particular, after the fall, if you are interested in a personally engraved first edition of After the Fall, there's a link on my website to my friends at an indie bookstore here called The Dog Eared Book. I have a deal with them where all the pre-orders of After the Fall, I will show up before they get shipped out. And my pledge is that I will write anything in those books that you want me to write.
Cool.
So if you want me to put in there, thank you so much for saving my life by donating a kidney, I will put that in the book for you and I will personally sign it. And also I will pledge to include at least one fun doodle in that as well.
Oh, fun.
So, you know, if you're interested in that, like I said, just you go to my website. It's the first right up at the top.
Awesome.
So it's an indie bookstore too, which I always like to support. Mm-hmm. So the more money we can throw those guys away, the happier I am. So if you're interested, I would strongly encourage you to give that a look.
That's awesome.
I love it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm a massive fan after I've now read Mickey 7 and After the Fall. I'm super excited for your next few books. I've decided that I need to find your previous books and read those as well. Mm-hmm. So thank you so much. It meant the world that you came onto the podcast for us.
Yes, well, thank we appreciate you.
This was great. It's a fun conversation, and I really appreciate you taking the time. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you.
Oh my gosh, you guys.
Sorry, I'm reading his website right now. I think this is 3 days in April bio, or it's just the end of his, it's the last bit on his page. It says, bored, confused about whether you can give a tattooed mouse an MRI, not sure whether you'll survive the robot apocalypse. All questions are answered here. I'm like, what is happening right now? I love it.
Well, I think that was the most mind-blowing part of this interview, was finding out that he freaking researches cancer.
I know. I feel so stupid saying that I only do audiobooks because I'm a single mom and I have kids. And here he is writing two books and doing cancer research at the same time. And I'm like,
read it right now.
I'm like such a little, what am I? Like a little hopeless girl that can't multitask and read a book and take care of children. And here he is saving the world and writing two books.
You said that. I don't think he thought anything of it, but that's hilarious.
I know. But I am so excited that the audiobook reader for Mickey 7 is
after the fall.
Because I'm so excited
to hear Mar talk.
I loved Mickey 7's audiobook, so I am so excited. So, but anyways, I just think that was a really fun interview, and I'm so grateful that he was on, and that was so much fun.
Oh, it was so fun. I loved learning about the whole process of Mickey 17 getting adapted. I loved finding out why it's Mickey 17.
I know.
Well, that came out naturally. I was like, oh, I'm so glad. And it also it made me sad that I didn't pick up on it. I don't think I ever would have picked up on it. I've watched that movie so many times and I've never once been like, he went from a child to a man.
I think it's one of those subtle things that directors like almost kind of do for them. So they're like, I know this. And it'll be cool if other people find out, but I'm not going to make it obvious. And so I liked it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought it was very cool. And were you rightfully nervous? Did you need to be that nervous all week?
No, I did not.
He was such a chill, nice, amazing person. That was
It was super fun.
It was so fun.
Oh, yeah. And like I told him, I'm a huge fan of his now after finishing After the Fall. Like, I was nervous reading it because we were doing this interview and I was like, what if I don't like it? I was also nervous because I'm trying to get ahead in our books for season 8 and was like, cool, I'm adding an extra book into my reading and this is going to slow me down because typically my For Me books that I end up picking up to read sometimes slow me down because I think I don't have a deadline on them for when I need to be done with reading it. Whereas off script books, I have that like, okay, I'm trying to get through them. So I was nervous that starting it was going to slow me down for us. But after the second chapter, I put it down and I think it was the next day I was at work and I couldn't stop thinking about the story. And I was wanting to figure out what was going to happen next. And I was like, oh, I think I'm a fan of his work.
That's awesome. I'm so excited for the audiobook. I also do not do other books because I have the same thing. And I'm like, I got to get through our off script. But I think I'm definitely going to pause and read.
Oh, this one, I think you should. Absolutely. I think you should. I think when I read it, It was the first time I've ever read a book that wasn't adapted that I thought, I think Allie would like it.
Wow.
So, okay. Yeah.
I'll have to for sure. I'm excited for it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think that was fun.
It was a blast. Again, thank you, Edward, for being on our podcast. It was amazing. Such a fun interview. I loved it so much.
And I assume this is coming out in January. So next month, y'all, go pick up After the Fall. February 24th is when it is released. What were you saying?
I was saying thanks, everyone, for sticking around and listening. Hope you enjoyed this awesome interview.
Yes, I did.
Honestly, been one of my favorite interviews that we've done. But
it was fun.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I agree. All right, everybody. Have a wonderful new year.
And we'll see you Monday for, what's your second book coming out? Is it Charlotte's Web Freak? Nope, not Freak. Freak's the third one.
Yeah.
Yep. That's it.
Okay. Bridge Terabithia. Monday.
Stay tuned.
Yes. All right.
See ya.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for sticking with us.
We hope you enjoyed it.
If you did, we would greatly appreciate it if you gave us 5 beautiful stars, reviewed, and subscribed.
You can also follow us on Facebook at Offscript, on Instagram at OffscriptPodcast21, and on TikTok at Offscript_pod.
Shout outs to Madam Ashen Creations for our adorable logo art.
And Adam Daniel for our incredible theme song.
And to Creative Cinephile Productions for producing our podcast.
See you next time.
Hi, I'm Serena.
And I'm Rachel.
We are the hosts of Book Tales.
If you like reading books,
drinking cocktails,
and Scottish accents,
then meet your new favourite podcast.
Come with us as we explore different themes from romanticism to horror and everything in between.
We pair each book with a bespoke cocktail and tell you everything you'll need to make one.
And each week, play our fun game tailored to each book.
Find Book Tales wherever you get your podcasts. So grab your book.
Grab your booze.
For Book Tales.